who know him intimately, call him, of course, Andy Gurr. I distinctly recall the day it was awarded to me, actually, in the 1990s, when I got my first email from Professor Gurr, signed off, that friendly Andy that those who know him are used to. Professor Gurr has retired from the University of Reading after a career in which he transformed our subject, that is, the study of theatre in Shakespeare's time. I say after that career, but of course it's not after. Professor Gurr's response to retiring has been only to accelerate his output rather than slow down. I haven't the time to list the books, but if you want to read about a general overview of this period, then read, obviously, Shakespearean Stage, now in its fourth edition. The Playgoers have their own book, Playgoers of Shakespeare's London. Particular theatre companies, first of all, are comprehensively surveyed in Shakespearean playing companies, and then individual companies, Shakespeare's company, the rival company, get their own monographs. It's not clear to the rest of us how he's doing it. And I think I've figured out what's going on. What's the secret? How is this man producing this enormous output of new knowledge about theatres of the period? And the answer is that Professor Gurr has perfected what many have tried and failed to perfect, I think, which is a time machine. He clearly, on those trips when he tells us he's going to New Zealand for a few weeks, is in fact travelling back to the 16th, 17th century and taking extraordinarily good notes. This is the only possible explanation for the output of our speaker today, Professor Andrew Gurr.
I'm very conscious of being in the present at the moment, and I will... Really, what I'm trying to do is to register the difference between us here and now and what it might have been if you really were an Elizabethan living in Elizabethan times. I mean, look, for instance, where we are now. We're all sitting in a row. I'm standing facing you. And that sitting and standing relationship is what I would call two-dimensional. And Shakespeare's plays were three-dimensional, which is one of the reasons why I've called my talk Why Was the Globe Round? It's two-dimensional because we're accustomed to use our eyes rather than our ears, to prioritize our eyes rather than our ears. And so we believe in speaking face-to-face. In this case, it's a monologue rather than a speech, than a dialogue, but nonetheless, you see my point. And I want to begin by looking at one of the most two-dimensional things we have, which are pictures, like that one. Most of you, I hope, are familiar with it. It's the De Witt's drawing, a Dutch tourist's drawing done in 1596 of the newly built Swan Theatre, built in 1595, on the South Bank, not very far from the Rose and the Globe. It's a very well-known but oddly deceptive image, this one. It's deceptive from my point of view, and I hope eventually from yours, because it's done from more or less the position where you would expect the projection booth in a cinema to be. It's done full face, frontal, and it's two-dimensional in every possible sense of the word. You can see how easy it is to view everything on the stage from that angle nowadays, but it's a deceptive angle, and it's deceptive because it's deceptive in relation to what Shakespeare's contemporaries thought about theatre, because it doesn't have any sense of the real roundness. It's got galleries that go around, and I'll talk about that shortly, but it's not really got any sense of being three-dimensional. If you look actually at, I'll find my pointer and show you. If you look up here actually, you'll see that it's screwed up. Or possibly DeWitt himself, or the man who copied this version of it, Arend van Buchel, in Amsterdam, they were trying to do a straight two-dimensional image, but here, in order to put in the turret with a man blowing his trumpet and a flag flying from it, and the flag there. They had to shift the perspective. So you've actually got two different perspectives in the one picture. That's part of the necessary falsification of doing things that are inherently three-dimensional in only two dimensions. Perspective doesn't always work comfortably. And of course, the reason why the globe was round, the simplest, the most obvious reason why the globe is round, is because, and I'm using my simplest answer first, there are a lot more complicated ones that will come a bit later. It was round because it was designed to give the audience the best opportunity to hear what the actors said, not to see what they did. That's a fundamental point. Even when you sit behind a speaker, you lose less than 10% of what they are saying. And this all-round configuration of the globe made it utterly different from all modern playhouses. And I'm not just talking about cinematic design of the auditorium as we have it here, so you can see the pictures. But almost all theatres still work in only two dimensions. I have to say, even the globe that some of us built for Sam Wanamaker 26 years ago, it's now regularly altered by the current artistic director or his directors to show the stage pictorially, almost as if it was going back to the proscenium arch days, in only two dimensions. He has stopped thinking in three dimensions about the globe, as he should be doing. And he's stopped even using the Lord's Rooms, which are at the back of the stage. And you'll notice here that the only audience actually visible are sitting what we would think of as backstage in the Lord's Rooms, the most expensive seats in the Swan, as they were the most expensive seats in the globe. The Lord's Rooms are not used at all these days by our Dominic, because he is not thinking about theatre in three dimensions, and nor are we. And it's tempting to make some small-scale correction to that that gives my reason for showing you these pictures. That, I think, is necessary to show you, because for all the arts of perspective, we have to bear in mind that this is a two-dimensional representation of a three-dimensional picture. It's actually a drawing by Wenceslas-Hollar in the 1630s of the second globe, the first one having burnt down in 1613. And it's probably the most accurate representation we have of the original globe in two dimensions. Let me show you, though, a bit more about this kind of thing. That's a detail by John Norden, drawn in 1599, of the Rose Playhouse, next door to where the globe was, and indeed quite close to where the new globe is. You'll see it's a six-sided structure, which shows you that you can't trust anybody, because even though he drew it live from the Tower of Southwark Cathedral in 1599, he only bothered to give it six sides, whereas, as we know from this illustration, Museum of London illustration of the Rose, when it was first built, it had 14 sides. And the idea that pictures can accurately represent a 14-sided structure as a six-sided structure is part of the kind of mystique that should make you suspicious of all kinds of evidence of all of this. It's actually the second stage of the Rose, this one, the one that we now know. It was enlarged on two sides to make a bigger shape, and the stage was pushed back a bit from the original fairly symmetrical 14-sided polygon that was the original structure of the Rose. This is much more colourful, actually. This is another of the great Walter Hodges' drawings, in which somebody, I think a bit improbably, is shooting an arrow from the stage out of the playhouse. It's a rather hopeful drawing, not one that we should really be making too much notice of. But you'll see that Walter's got a nice representation of the galleries and the way in which everybody looked around. And also, perhaps most to the point, a point that relates to my reasons for the globe being round, the central figure is right at the front edge of the stage, near enough to being in the center of the entire circuit of listening people. I'll give you a few more illustrations of the inevitability of roundness in the early theatres. You may know these drawings. They're actually drawn by, we now think, or at least Gordon Higgott thinks, that they were drawn in as late as 1660, but are almost certainly copies of much earlier drawings, which I will give you evidence for in a moment or two. It was originally thought, when it was first identified as a set of drawings of a theatre, as being of the cockpit built in Drury Lane, the first Drury Lane theatre, back in 1616. But it's probably not, and I'll give you slightly more detailed images here. This is the ground plan of the building, and you can see the stage here. You can see where an actor would have stood to speak there, and you have a complete circuit of audience. But it's a complete circuit of audience, not simply in terms of these oddly curved seats in the pit. In fact, they reflect. We puzzled over these for a long time when we thought we were going to use these drawings, as indeed they are now being put to practical use to build the indoor theatre, the second theatre at the Globe, in New Globe Walk. These are the drawings that show, even in the pit, where we would normally expect people to go that away, they actually go round this way, because that was the centre of the circle. So you've got curved seats there. Much more to the point, though, you also have people sitting two boxes on each side of the stage and people sitting right across there. And the most expensive seats were not those here or even those up in the gallery, but in the upper gallery, but around here. The boxes cost half a crown or 30 times as much as it cost to stand in the yard of the Globe. Let me show you a slightly different set of pictures which show you something similar. You can see here you've got the boxes which go right to the side of the stage, on each side of the stage. That's the front stage. That's the lower boxes where you paid half a crown, 2 and 6, to sit. These are equally expensive seats. And across the back, you have lined up, as you can see, with the bench seating, four ranks of seating behind what we think of as behind the stage. And they were the most expensive seats in the house. That's a factor that I think we need to take careful note of, because they reflect the extent to which proximity was far more important than frontal position, where you could see. Getting a hearing was always the priority rather than getting a sight. In fact, that argument was one of the ones that was used at the Globe when they decided to use these drawings as the model for the indoor theatre, the equivalent to the Blackfriars, that is now in process of construction at the Globe site. And they clearly indicate, not that they were original drawings made by John Webb, Inigo Jones's assistant, in 1660, but that they were made much earlier as part of the idea of theatre in the round, the circular Globe. Lost my clicker now. Oh, sorry, yeah, okay. Yeah. I want to move on. Yeah. This, of course, is, I thought I'd show you that just to remind you of what we built some years ago as a round theatre. It's still got many of the features that we think were appropriate to it, and it's available for experience, though whether it was big, whether it's the right size is one of the many questions we have to ask. But it is a fairly faithful replica, and I'll come back to a moment about the faithfulness of the replica with some of the other pictures I want to show you. We have of course, from the most eloquent of all the writers of the time, other than Shakespeare, Ben Jonson. Clear evidence that the priority of the ear over the eye was certainly something shared by all the poets. It isn't necessarily something that we go along with or would go along with even now. But in those days, the poets, of course, had what you might politely call a vested interest, a commercial interest, in getting people to come and listen to their plays rather than to see what the actors did. Ben Jonson, in the prologue to A Staple of News, a play he wrote in 1626 for the Shakespeare Company, he provided a rather despairing address to the audience. "Would you have come to hear, not see, a play?" he wrote. "Though we, his actors, must provide for those who are our guests, here, in the way of shows, the maker," that's Jonson himself, of course, "hath not so. He'd have you wise much rather by your ears than by your eyes." That was straight commerce, of course, for the hearing of poetry, the words that Shakespeare and the others wrote. It's possibly, of course, one of the many reasons why the plays are so long by modern standards, because the words are all we have of the originals. Jonson was openly grieving that in the audiences of his time, spectators were triumphing over hearers. And indeed, it's a reflection of our own lack of readiness to concede change or to acknowledge that change is really happening, that we still use the word audience, meaning hearers, for a theatre audience, for people who go to the theatre, rather than spectators, people who go to see. Hamlet himself, Shakespeare himself, in fact, used the word auditors constantly through his earlier plays. Midsummer Night's Dream, Robin Goodfellow actually says, "I'll be an auditor to the play that he's going to eavesdrop on." It wasn't until Hamlet that Shakespeare changed his terminology and started to talk, from then on, to talk about spectators, as if he was acknowledging defeat to some degree. It's in Hamlet, of course, that Hamlet himself speaks of the idle spectators who come for nothing but noise and shows. Jonson took the other view, of course. "Scholars that can judge and fair report the sense they hear from the vulgar sort of nutcrackers that only come for sight." So if you come as a spectator, you're automatically, by Jonson's criteria at any rate, and possibly also by Shakespeare's, more stupid than if you come to listen. It's a bald criticism, but of course, and it was totally self-interested, given that the poets wrote words for their actors to speak and not didn't write shows for them to be seen by. It was a very long-held grievance, that, and it's a major factor. Jonson elevated words above action, meaning acting, matter above words. You've not just got to use words, you've got to use meaningful words, as Jonson acknowledged. And from the outset of his writing in 1598, he was absolutely emphatic about the superiority of listening carefully to the plays rather than the sight of an actor speaking. Well, as I said, the actors were biased since they wanted those who paid for their plays to listen to the words rather than just admire the players. But their priority reflects quite precisely the concept that lay behind the building of the first commercial playhouses. This is where I move from hearing to money, of course. That priority has not at all itself disappeared, but the priority of hearing has, and of course we've now got so much electronic amplification that we might well wonder why it should be there should be any trouble taken to reconstruct the original without any amplification, as the Globe, I hope, still does not do. We've got a total loss of the reasons for our priority of hearing over seeing. But still, the subject is the playing venues, and therefore, largely because we're now dominated by the visual rather than the oral, I'm going to show you a few more pictures. They do tell you a little bit more, but don't, of course, trust any of them, least of all this one. Even the square playhouses, I should say, for instance, the Boar's Head, which was built out of an inn yard, the Fortune, which was built to a square plan by the builder of the Globe a year after the Globe, and the Red Bull, built in 1604, all three of them quite square. But they were designed not as polygons, but as squares, and yet they were still on the same principle of hearing rather than seeing. The contract for the building of the Fortune, which has survived in the Dulwich papers, which Grace has been making available photographically now, openly acknowledge the priority of the circular design. The contract states quite explicitly that the stage was to protrude from the tiring house, where the actors came in, into the middle of the yard, where the players were to make their speeches. The square frame was to contain, and I quote from the contract, a stage and tiring house to be made, erected, and set up within the said frame with a shadow or cover over the said stage, which stage shall contain in length 40 3 feet of lawful size, and in breadth to extend to the middle of the yard of the said house. It was very important that the stage extended right into the middle of the yard so that the actors could speak in the middle, as they were in those Worcester College drawings that I showed you earlier. You were in the centre of a complete circuit of audience. There was, of course, however, this is where I move on to my second criterion, the financial reasons for building playhouses round, or at least polygonal. In our concern about the nature of the playhouses, we should note there was an excellent reason for building the first ones, another part of what you might well call my circular argument. And that was money, of course. The exterior walls were built to surround the audience, to stop anybody getting in to see the play who didn't pay. That was far more profitable than the old marketplace tradition, where the actors would set up a booth in the marketplace and anybody who came along would then be invited to put money into a hat by one of the spare actors. Not a thing that, of course, everybody would be ready to do. But we know also how incredibly profitable first the expectation of building the playhouses was, and then, of course, the financing of them. The first five commercial playhouses were all appeared pretty well together in a rush through the years 1575 to 77, and that came only 3 or 4 years after the Usury Act of 1572. Usury Act was about what you might expect usury to be concerned with, the lending of money at interest. And it tried to clear up the whole business of money lending, which was dangerously lawless up to then, as a major activity of the London's Royal Exchange. It actually legitimised not the 6% that the Bible authorised, but 10% a year for large loans, though, of course, in later years an even more extortionate rate was being charged. There's a play of 1597 in which a Portuguese man who may or may not have been Jewish was, in imitation of Shylock, of course, was accused of, or rather was boasted of, lending money at more than 20% a year interest. It was that paid for the early playhouses. I've written recently about The Merchant of Venice, where Shylock, I think, was intended to be seen as a moneylender simply on the basis of the fact that at the same time as he did that, Richard Burbage's father, James Burbage, who built the Blackfriars for the company at, as we've been told already, £600, a major amount of money, was being dunned by the moneylenders because the Blackfriars, for its first 4 years, was not able to be used. The locals put up the NIMBY principle and argued that they didn't want a playhouse in their backyard, so it was blocked, which meant no money was coming in to pay off the moneylenders. And surprise, surprise, Shakespeare wrote Merchant of Venice at the same time. It's actually, I think, probably the first explicit indication that Shakespeare ever gave that he really had a feeling of fellowship with his fellow players. Now, I want to make a short sidetrack now, because in closing the plays behind their polygonal walls, had many consequences besides the advantage of bringing income to the to their investors. I've been recently hearing the word banksters, which I think is a perfect word for the current process of money lending and things that go with it. At the Rose Dig in 1989, the archaeologists found thousands of fragments of pottery. Clearly, they assumed, and it's there in Julian Bausch's lovely book about the excavations on the Rose and the Globe sites. Clearly, most people went to a performance in the afternoon. They were always done in daylight to maximise the visible light. Were done to bringing food in pots, food and drink, so that they could enjoy themselves in a more wholesale way. That's a pot taken from Julian's book, of obviously used for drinking, for holding wine. It's clearly got a cork space at the top. And that kind of pottery is something that made me wonder yet again. It's not just the pictures that you can't trust. It's possibly the pottery as well. Because, of course, consuming a lot of food and drink has its side effects. And we know that the Globe and other venues lacked what you might politely call any formal means to dispose of your waste products. When we were building the Globe with its walls of lath and plaster, I did actually run one short experiment, which never got into the records, I'm happy to say. Once the plaster, using original lime plaster, that was one of the great things we did with the Globe. We used all the original materials. And lime plaster was terribly out of fashion back in the 1980s when we started working it. And nobody knew what the effects of lime plaster were. Gypsum plaster, which is what is mostly used these days, is much easier, much smoother to work. And there were all sorts of restrictions on using lime plaster, which we didn't really understand until we'd been working with it. It's now much more commonplace and more frequently used. But I thought I'd better see whether the effect of urine on plaster would actually show itself, because there's one feature of the Globe, which you can see if you go to the top gallery level of the Globe. Because the seating is raked up in each one, the top gallery has to have such a steep rake that you only get about two or three ranks of people there, and you've got a lot of space left behind. And I always wondered whether the topmost gallery, the back of the topmost gallery, would be very convenient for gentlemen who had a need to make use of what you might call available space. I'm happy to say, by the way, that the lime plaster was wonderfully impervious to damage. But there are all sorts of other things. And let me show you this picture. It's actually a Dutch painting by Willem Pieterts Buitenvecht. But notice what the gallant on the left-hand side is doing. Show you a bit more detail. You can see it slightly better there. He's actually disposing of his waste product in a pottery bowl. And that does make me wonder if the identification of the uses for the pottery that the archaeologists have been working on for the last few years, whether they got it all quite right, as they should. I should, by the way, thank John Estington, my colleague in Toronto, for reproducing this picture. He actually put it in an issue of Theatre Notebook last year with a dedication to me, because he knew I had been pursuing these questions sometimes in the past. Still, we should move on, and I want to show you this, which is an illustration of one of the many venues that was certainly used for plays. This is Hardwick Hall, actually, and it's the main gallery section of Hardwick Hall. You notice the hall here. What we don't know, and this is the really frustrating thing, this is the usual hall, of course, with a big fireplace and a kind of gallery there. We don't know whether the actors would have come in there to do their piece, whether they would have come in there to do their piece, and where they would have done. Would they have put up a booth stage there? Would they have acted in front of the fireplace, which is the obvious, otherwise the obvious focus of the room? We just do not know, and even my thinking of the globe as a round space makes me wonder quite where they might have positioned their stage. We have, of course, done some experiments over the years. Middle Temple Hall actually offered its main hall, and we know that Twelfth Night was acted in the main hall at Middle Temple Hall in 1602, Candlemas 1602. But we don't know where they put the stage, even there. And so we have many questions. Same applies to Hampton Court, where the Great Hall was also used for royal performances. We know where the king might have been positioned from 1603 onwards, but we don't know for sure where the actors would have been and how round the stage still was. There are all too many things that we really do not know nearly as well as we should. I want to move on inevitably to what might have happened inside the theatres. And this is an illustration of what we might see as distinct from what we might have heard at Titus Andronicus. It's a pretty macabre picture, I think. One can't really be very confident about much of it, except that it was clearly drawn in 1594, quite early in the life of Titus Andronicus. We know that Titus Andronicus was staged at the Rose in 1594, and it would very likely have then moved with the new Shakespeare company formulated in May of that year to act at the theatre. But you've got a real mix there. You've got Titus himself in what I suppose you might think of as Roman. It certainly wasn't Elizabethan. Tamora, also possibly Elizabethan. Aaron, the Moor, pointing significantly, of course, at the tip of his sword as one of the murderer's characters. But there you've got these rather odd-looking soldiers, undoubtedly not Roman, probably Elizabethan, though even the Elizabethan costume is pretty old-fashioned by soldierly counts. You can't just tell. And the evidence is not only regrettably minimal, but also regrettably, I suspect, inaccurate in many ways. You can't be sure about anything in any of this, except perhaps that the globe was round. I've got one or two other pictures that I thought you might like to see. This is actually a page from a book done in 1642, as an aid for death, John Bulwer's Chirologia and Chironomia, in which he indicates gestures that might have been standard and might have been capable of being recognised as body language that would have gone with the acting of the plays. Somebody holding a rather dead-looking hand, gesture of amity there, and various other gestures. I won't go into them in detail. I've got a page of one of my books that talks about that. But it's odd and awkward. And you need to think in terms of how standard the body language might have been. This page actually was originally used by a quite splendid scholar called Bertrand Joseph, who produced the first edition of his book on Elizabethan acting and claimed on the basis of this kind of evidence that the acting was clearly rather formalistic, stylized. You had standard gestures for standard activities. He was attacked for it quite heavily by some of the American scholars and later produced a second edition in which he used the identical evidence to prove exactly the opposite, that acting was naturalistic. You can't do too much about that. I want to close with that, which I think, and I hope, none of you have ever really seen before. It's a macabre picture, and it had a function in Shakespeare's Tempest, which actually delights me no end, because it clearly was exactly the kind of object that you would have seen on the stage in the scene where Stefano enters drunk to Caliban and Trinculo, both hiding under Caliban's gabardine, and offers them drink. And this is what he would have had round his neck. You can see the two holes where you could put a string and or a leather thong and wrap it around your neck. This is actually a leather bottle. It's actually comes from Parham Hall in East Sussex and is a genuine Elizabeth. It's the only one actually that I know anywhere in the country at the moment that is a genuine English-made Elizabethan thing. It's made out of leather, a bit like a shoe. You can see the stitching down the sides. It's got a pot. It's got a spout there where you put your sherry, as Stefano has it, in and then drank out of it. You see the cap, the spout that's there with this leather around it for the to hang around your neck. So it's easy to get access to if you want to drink straight out of the bottle, as of course everybody did. It's a leather bottle, and it's used by Stefano as a version of the other leather-bound object that is the main feature of Prospero's own activities. Prospero had a book, and books were also invariably bound in leather. And what Shakespeare was doing in that scene in The Tempest was parodying Prospero's book with Stefano's bottle. In fact, during that very scene, Stefano makes Caliban swear to him by the book, as he says, and he gives him the bottle on which to put his hands to swear by, just as you routinely put your hands on a leather-bound Bible to swear, and indeed are still required to swear in courtrooms here and now. That, in other words, was a parody of a book. And if you think a little further, the book of wisdom that Prospero has, which is perhaps like the Bible, but certainly deals out a great wealth of good information, is exactly the opposite to what you get out of this leather-bound object, the alcoholic, the bottle full of sherry, or sack, as Stefano calls it. So you had a visual game going on in The Tempest. Now, The Tempest was, as I've been arguing in the past, the first play Shakespeare actually wrote for the Blackfriars Theatre, which was the beginning of the future, as it were, for the Shakespeare Company and indeed for all acting. The Blackfriars was a model that was reproduced in the Restoration when the theatres reopened after 18 years of closure during the Civil War. And the Blackfriars became the model for all indoor theatres thereafter. It seems to me nice to think that Shakespeare was conceding the need for seeing things as well as hearing things by the time he got round to writing his last play or his last solo play, The Tempest. And this illustrates that to me as well as you can get any of these things. Now, I could go on, I'm afraid, but I'm certainly not going to attempt to now. I think I've completed my circuit of the circular evidence, so I will stop there. Thank you.
Yes. Can I leave it? There should be two roving mics in the audience. So please, Professor Gerr has agreed to take questions. Can you raise your hand and wait for the mic to come to you? We'll need some chairs for the panel, yes. So, go ahead. Second row down.
I have a question. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the role of the groundlings and whether Shakespeare and his contemporaries sort of accommodated how the groundlings would participate in the actual play.
There's remarkably little evidence about that, I'm afraid. Actually, I'm rather glad there's remarkably little, because it does seem to me that an audience that is listening intently is not going to throw tomatoes or anything like that in the course of the performance. There is a single documented instance at the Red Bull Theatre in 1620 when an apprentice, you know, a youth, a young man, was actually sitting on the edge of the stage to watch the play. He must have decided that he could get closer to the action, or that he wouldn't be in any trouble, that, or they wouldn't actually kick him off the stage, because most of the stages, we think, were about 5 feet high, so it would have been quite a climb to get there. And indeed, they were 5 feet high in order to stop people climbing up onto the stage. But the Red Bull had apprentices capable of hauling themselves or getting their friends to heave them up onto the stage. And he was sitting there, and he was hit by a sword wielded by one of the actors. So being a fair, theatrical-minded activist, he wrote a challenge to the actor to come and meet him in a duel. And he actually threatened that if he didn't live up to the request to come and challenge him to the duel, he would collect 1,400 of his fellow apprentices. They're all felt makers, actually, and come and attack the theatre. So of course they brought in the local authority and stopped it. So nothing happened. But the letter is there, threatening to challenge the actor. That's about the only tangible evidence we have of what you might call positive interaction. There is a late account by an Oxford don, called Edmund Gayton, about going to the theatre where if the audience didn't like the play, they would kick up a fuss and make the actors stage a different play instead, which is pretty drastic indication of the power of audiences, the authority that an audience would have to bully the actors into doing what they wanted. And there's a few references of that kind, but mostly the best evidence we have actually came from one of the diplomats, a Venetian diplomat, who wrote about the Florentine diplomat, who he thought was an idiot, going to a play at the Curtain in 1613, pretending to be a member of a non-gentry, an ordinary common or garden man, and standing in the yard, which of course is where the cheapest places were and where the workmen and the apprentices all stood. And at the end of the play, the actors came out to announce what the next day's play was going to be. But the audience didn't like it very much, so they shouted for a different play. And this Florentine diplomat shouted along with them. But of course, he didn't know any English anyway, so he was just making the noise that they were making. And they turned on him because he was clearly not one of them. I mean, this sort of thing happens in audiences, as you might expect. And that's about, those two are the most tangible pieces of evidence about, apart from occasional things about people throwing nuts or nutshells or apples, which are, of course, the commonest form of food that anybody would be eating in the playhouses. But apart from that, there is very, very little evidence for it happening regularly. You might actually say, sorry, one final point about that. The lack of evidence, possibly, I mean, there was a case of the Blackfriars, for instance, which was very spectacular on stage. Or in the balcony at the side of the stage, but the lack of evidence is a bit like, leaves you making the assumption that is a bit like the fact that we've only got about 200 out of the 800 or 1,000 plays that must have been written through this period. We've only 200 got into print or were kept in manuscript. And the assumption that is so easy to make out of that is that we must have got all the best plays, like the Shakespeare's, because they were printed, and that the less good plays didn't survive. I'm not sure that that's true, and I'm not sure either that those very small bits of evidence about audience misbehaving aren't part of the same thing. It's only the noteworthy and abnormal things that get commented on. Therefore, the ordinary run of audience behaviour is just unknown. One of the many things I'm happy to say we don't know anything about.
This this is slightly tangential, but the earlier the theatre was quoted as the first purpose-built theatre, but I always thought that, the Red Lion was the first purpose-built in the sense that it was built as a theatre as opposed to an inn-yard. And I just would be interested to know your view on that. Yes.
The Red Lion was not an inn-yard. It was certainly built specifically for performance, and it had galleries as well as a stage, but it was temporary. It was 1567, 9 years before the theatre was built. And it was largely financed by James Burbage's brother-in-law, who was a very rich grocer who clearly didn't know what to do with his money, so he put it into building a theatre. But there's absolutely no evidence except the lawsuit over the building, which is where the evidence is, that was the first attempt to do it. I think that there was such a flurry of new theatres in 1575 to 77, the Theatre, the Curtain, the First St. Paul's, the First Blackfriars, and Newington Butts, south of the river. Five theatres all built within 3 years. That must be a consequence of the Usury Act. That's why I mentioned it, because it seems to me to be the trigger, the moment when it became possible to invest money and expect a legally justified, healthy return on your investment.
Hello. I love the idea that the people wanted the seats at the back of the stage, the half-crown seats, because they could hear better. But was there any element of them wanting to be seen, the people who would pay that amount of money, and so the kind of celebrity culture notion?
I think that's a very likely subject. We don't know for sure. It's a logical conclusion, isn't it, that it would certainly be a very conspicuous place to be. I mean, I've sat up in the, when they were still allowing audience to sit in the Lord's Rooms, as they were called, at the Globe. I sat up there, and it was a lovely position to be in for listening. It wasn't nearly so good for seeing. One of the things I saw was King Lear, and in that early version of King Lear, the Julian Glover version, they actually hanged the fool in the Discovery space underneath the Lord's Rooms, and we never saw that because we were sitting up listening to the play rather than seeing the play. That you might argue is the sort of thing that a modern director would do because he expected the audience to be two-dimensional rather than three-dimensional and not to be sitting all around the stage. There's very little otherwise. There is a reference I found actually to a group of lords playing cards during the performance, which of course you could easily do if you were bored. And indeed, if you felt you had to wait for something exciting to happen, you would play cards while you're waiting. But that also seems to me to be a rather conspicuous thing, a conspicuous indication of boredom for the to impress the people in the yard, that sort of thing. But there's very little else in the way of tangible evidence about what people would have done. There's even been a suggestion made quite recently that the Lord's Rooms might have been curtained off for some cases. Why the hell they would do that, I don't know, except, of course, that it absolutely prioritised the ear over the eye if you were sitting backstage there. And there was an instance when Henrietta Maria went to the Blackfriars Theatre, the only royalty, Charles's queen, the only royalty to actually go to a theatre. She went four times to the Blackfriars in the 1630s. And she allegedly, on the first occasion, sat behind a curtain so that people wouldn't see her.
Oh, yes, I was interested in the your comment about, I'm over here, about the enclosure, the sort of post-capitalist, in a way, reason for enclosing the theatre. But then I'm a bit less convinced by this distinction of three and two-dimensional, partly because I always think when I hear lectures about Shakespeare theatre that we don't say enough about the Renaissance aspect, i.e. the revival of antiquity. And I've been revisiting recently my thoughts about Lord Cranbourne's 1609 journey with Inigo Jones, as I argue, and I'm reproaching this, but I mean, 1609, they certainly, both of them, and perhaps together, visited the Theatre Orange. And there, one doesn't really, you know, see this problem, I think, between two and three dimensional, if I understand it correctly. It's a sort of, obviously, the development of putting the stage more in the centre is something that happens, and it may be connected with your argument about maximising profit. But I wonder what your thoughts are about that, what must have loomed very large, as in every other aspect of culture, visual and literary, the revival of antiquity, and the knowledge that they clearly had of the remains of theatres, not just in Rome, but in southern France, where I found that quite a lot of English people travelled in the Elizabethan period rather clandestinely, and then after the peace treaty with Spain in 1604 more openly.
Yes. It's a very complex question that, at least it's very complex to try and answer it. I absolutely agree that the fundamental shape of both Greek and Roman theatres was D-shaped rather than absolutely in the round. Epidaurus, for instance, has that great slope that goes down the other side of the scena of where the actors stood to do their speaking. And it's even more true in a sense of the Roman theatres, where the D shape is quite clear. And Ben Jonson's folio of plays actually reproduces a Roman theatre, a D-shaped theatre, quite clearly on the title page of it. So there's no doubt that the D-shaped concept was well known. The anomaly is that the most tangible evidence we have about all of the theatres, the location of the Lord's rooms, for instance, there were gentlemen's rooms on each flank of the stage, but actually the Lord's room, this is something where Gabriel and I have disagreed in the past, I know, but the actual positioning of the Lord's rooms were literally over the stage, as people described them, and they must have been on the stage balcony. Because they're there in the Worcester College drawings, which I showed you, that four ranks of seating at the back of the music room in the centre of the stage balcony. Those are undoubtedly seats for the expensive bottoms that would have expected to sit on them. So there is actually, in a sense, the whole history of theatre has this one great anomaly, which is that only in Shakespeare's time and at no other time, certainly not after 1660, were theatres built in the three dimensions, in the round. And the most expensive seats, undoubtedly, we know at the Blackfriars, we know at the Cockpit, we know at the Worcester College drawings, they were all designed with the most expensive seats in what we think of as backstage.
Well, I think it's very interesting. I think it confirms, I mean, your mention of the usury law and everything, I think it confirms this fantastic bursting out of capitalism in the late Elizabethan period. And when it all settles down and culture becomes, you know, theatre becomes a more normal thing, they can settle back into not cramming in the seats, including celebrity seats, as we just heard, behind and to the side. And it's very interesting. Yes, thank you.
Yes. There are other factors that are anomalous as well in all of this. I mean, if you look at, for instance, the Cockpit at Court, which Inigo Jones redid for King Charles in 1629, it's got a dais. It's the most undemocratic auditorium you could possibly ask for. It's got the dais, which with separate steps down each side for King Charles to come down and sit himself, and his queen, of course, if she was with him, on their own there. And everybody else is gathered around. And you'd obviously, it was designed so that audience could look back at the king as well as at the stage, you know, both ways. But the king's position was, like De Witt and the Swan drawing, in what you would count as a proscenium, the projection booth of a cinema. It was facing the stage. There are so many contradictions built into it. I mean, it's a bit like the fact that we still talk of audiences as audiences rather than as spectators. It's all part of the same process of interaction and competition and lack of explicit clarity from almost everybody except Ben Jonson about whether you should see or hear a play.
Good afternoon. My name is Robert Holden and I was one of the Rose Theatre campaigners in 1989, and you and I would have stood shoulder to shoulder in that extraordinary summer. I brought my photographic archive to show you afterwards just to remind you of those extraordinary days. Just one thing about the film, Grace did talk about the Henslow Papers and mentioned the British Library and the Bodleian. I hope in the course of the film she mentions the fact that they are deposited at Dulwich College, which has this extraordinary, extraordinary world-famous archive, including Henslow's diary, which these hands have actually touched, not with gloves on, I hesitate to add, but these hands have actually touched Henslow's diaries. Just to say about two things at the Rose Theatre. I love what you were saying about lack of evidence. The fact is that the drip line that was found at the outside of the Rose, turned whatever they thought it was, it turned out to be the drip line which gave away the extent of the overhang of the roof, which was an extraordinary thing to discover. But the one thing that I love is the fact that the hazelnuts that were found, the archaeologists started speculating, and the question was, were they the popcorn of Elizabethan Shakespearean theatre, or were they ground covering? And I think what, to reassure you, sir, is that lack of evidence is wonderful, because it's what's kept scholars like you going for years and years and years.
Well, I can give you different answers to those two precise questions. The drip line is a real problem at the moment, because the distance of the drip line from the actual walls, the inner supporting walls of the yard, is not enough. If the roof of the the thatch roof of the Rose, which would have dripped water straight down, of course, to create that drip line, had been on a three-story set of galleries, it should have been further in than it was. It's the right sort of distance from the walls, in from the walls, for a two-level set of galleries. So we've got that real question whether the Rose actually had a third level of galleries at all, raised by that issue. And that's unresolved, one of the many things that are unresolved. Over the nutshells, my very good late colleague and friend John Orrell actually found an article published in, dare I say, 1596, which is round about the middle of the theatre building period, which makes it quite clear. It actually was a pamphlet that was advertising the value of the waste products of the soap factories, of which there were many all around that part of Southwark, for road surfacing purposes. In other words, the nutshells came in to the soap factories, were broken up, and the lye was used to make soap. The lye from the nuts was used to make soap. That made the nutshells redundant. And the nutshells and a mix of silt from the river, we actually analysed some of the Rose when it was found, and it was a mix of river silt, freshwater silt, of very rough cement, roughly 25% cement, and nutshells. And the nutshells were clearly intended as a bulking component in the making of the cement, which covered the yard. I mean, there were several layers, of course, in the yard of the Rose, because over the years it obviously needed replacing fairly regularly. And they would have done that with this rough, familiar sort of surfacing mix. I mean, it's a lovely story. I mean, Sam Wanamaker actually started the popcorn. He actually was reported in the press as saying, "We've found the Elizabethan popcorn from the nutshells." But it wasn't that. I think it was the John Orrell, was being one of the scholars who was backing Sam, said. He published very tactfully, and only in an academic article, and he never drew it to Sam's attention, that the reality was the waste product from making soap, which is a very sad, inadequate compensation for it not being real popcorn, isn't it? But there are, of course, any number of records in the written evidence about nutcrackers. I mean, I quoted you one, the one about nutcrackers that only come for sight, which is what Johnson said. People who, the apprentices who would stand there in the yard cracking their nuts with their, you know, you can crack hazelnuts with your hand. I found an old guy, I was actually in Toronto, come to think of it, talking about the hazelnut shells. And I said, I've been trying to crack we get cob nuts, of course, if you're a very big version of hazelnut. The smaller ones are much easier to crack. And he said, I can crack even a cob nut for you. And he just went like that, and he cracked it, perfect. It was an exemplification of what you might call folkloristic habits that we have now forgotten, I think.
First of all, we did film all those scenes at Dulwich, and the Henslow Allen papers are online, all of them at henslow-allen.org.uk, or just Google Henslow or Allen, and we come up first. Excellent, excellent. And John Wyver, who filmed it, very much enjoyed putting his hands on Henslow's diary, too. One question for you, talking from D to O, why did Henslow and Allen insist, or perhaps Peter Street insist, that the fortune be square?
It's a good question. They didn't have a lot of land, and I think Allen was absolutely determined to build in Clerkenwell, not on the South Bank again. Because, you know, the leasehold of the Rose only had another few years to go. And I think Allen had bigger ambitions, and they were better represented up north. And it was the square he got. And he filled out the square. The only inner area of that 80-foot square space was for the staircases, I suspect, though we don't even know exactly where they are. That's one of the many questions we still have to work on, I think. I mean, You can see how many more questions I have than answers in all of this. And it's inevitably true, because even the questions can get properly questioned if you can spend time on that sort of thing.
Inevitably. Thanks very much, everyone.
Sorry, no, it's not.
Okay. He's foregoing his opportunity to ask the question. There is another Q&A just coming up. Yeah. I'd like us, first of all, please thank Professor Gove for his talk. The last act of this, I hope, comedy, not tragedy, the last event of the day is there's going to be a question and answer session where all the team members on Shout will take any questions from the floor in case anybody does want to know more about what the project has done and what they can do with our materials. So I can invite, please, Morris and Peter to take seats on the stage with Andy. And we have... Can we have the other mics as well? So are there any questions anybody wants to ask about the Shout project in particular? Michael Dobson and Nicola beside him. And please let us know who you want to answer.
Thanks. It's a fantastic project. As you say, a giving one. It's incredibly generous what you've made available. It's going to be wonderful. I'm sure everyone here is extremely excited about it. And so I'm, of course, going to ask something ungenerous, which is a kind of cavilling point, and it's addressed to anyone involved in compiling the map, which is clearly a fabulous map. What I'm curious as to what the sort of backstage discussions were about what got included and what didn't, because it seems to me very surprising that you've neglected the opportunity to send a potential 18,000 tourists to bang on the door of the Ministry of Defence and demand the right to dig up the foundations of the Great Hall at Whitehall. I mean, well done on sending those 18,000 tourists to bother 10 Downing Street looking for the cockpit in court. But I'm surprised that the Great Hall at Whitehall, which I was always taught was the venue for the first recorded performance of King Lear and all those other plays done at court, I'm surprised it doesn't feature on the map.
You're saying that the cockpit at court is not shown?
No, I'm saying the Great Hall of Whitehall Palace is not shown.
Ah. Well, that's because I don't know why that is.
Pass it to Andy.
I think it's because we didn't go into the whole detail of Whitehall Palace very much. Cockpit of court, but you know, not the surrounds.
Well, okay.
But anyway.
There are limitations as to what you can do. And that was one of the many ones. And what we felt was that we could only record what is currently available to be seen,
right,
or to be visited by tourists. And that was as far as we felt we could go.
Good. So they are going to bang on the door of number 10 Downing Street, assuming they can get in. That's good.
Yeah. I don't think you were there, but I did go to 10 Downing Street at one point, and we were shown the one bit of wall that might actually have been a bit of the cockpit at court. That was rather nice, but we weren't allowed to touch it or do anything like that. Mm. And the chances of the public being admitted to it at any stage. And we did put up the Inigo Jones banqueting house, even though that is pretty marginal, because they didn't allow plays to be staged there. And once the Rubens ceiling was put up, they refused to allow it to be used even for masks. Mm. So it was only, as it were, on the fringes of all of it. And I have to say, we were most concerned with, you might say, the populist end of the whole operation, the commercial theatres, as distinct from the royal theatres and the royal activity. And we have got references in the map to Hampton Court and the like. But that's about as far, literally as far as we could really go, I think.
I think I can add a little bit more on that now. It all comes back to me. If Julian Boucher were here, I'm not sure if he is yet. He's not, no. Julian Boucher's, I discussed all this with him, if you remember. The location of the cockpit at court is not necessarily, I don't think, at the back of Downing Street. Because if you look at the, there's various bits of evidence. He locates it much further west towards St. James's Park. And if you look at the Dankert's painting from St. James's Park towards Whitehall, done in about the 1670s, I think it was about. That's the only image that I've come across that shows actually the building with the lantern roof of the cockpit at court. And it's probably not so near to Downing Street as we think it is from the book about Whitehall Palace, the English Heritage Archaeology. Simon Thurley book. He talks about the back wall of, I think, number 10, doesn't he? From the archaeology. But there seems to be a conflict there between what Julian Boucher has done, and he's a senior archaeologist, Museum of London, obviously, and what Simon Thurley came up with.
Well, your map does say the cockpit in court was at number 10, but it's not the cockpit I'm bothered about. It's the hall where they did the straight plays for the royal family.
My previous speaker. Let's go with his comment.
Nicola had one next, and then wait.
I really would like to offer my congratulations on what's a beautifully put together project. And my question is to do really with nuts and bolts. I specialise in literature and tourism, which is one reason why I'm so interested in this tourist-facing project. And I'm particularly interested in the business of constructing apps for around literary locations of one sort or another. I think my question really is, how have you solved the really rather difficult problem of rendering the app both commercial, and how are you solving the problem of the sustainability of server space and the sort of conserving to the future? Where is it housed, and how are you financing that?
I'll take that one. The university, Dwardford University, guarantees to keep the server up for a certain length of time. But actually, there is no solution to bit rot, as they call it. Computer software always dies. The printed map and the guide will last much longer than anything else. The website has been made in such a way that it is conservable if, after the guaranteed funding period and sustainability period, after that expires, the way it's been made, using the tools, our software developer's very last screen, actually, was showing you things that said Ubuntu, MySQL, and a bunch of other Python, a bunch of other software techniques, packages, they call them, that is all open source. One thing you'll have noticed about what I've been saying about the project is this word open access, or giving stuff away
not proprietary materials. The website's been made with open source software. That it's highly sustainable if one is able to do that. So it has the highest chance of surviving. The text does, and the pictures do, and video standards are fairly long surviving. Apps haven't been around very long and will not be around very much longer, if you believe me, actually. To have a separate kind of software that isn't Windows or Apple, but is iOS or Android, isn't going to last very long. Websites and apps are going to merge. You'll be able to look at our website on your smartphone and use that rather than a custom-made app. So in our funding bid, we said, don't expect the app to last for more than a couple of years. There are no apps older than 5 years in existence, really. So some of the outputs will last longer than others, and we have taken the philosophical view that open source and open access are goods, in the general kind of social good sense, and we've used them wherever possible. That gets a whole wider question about open access, which of course is a very vexed area, a very vexed discussion in arts and humanities. If anybody wants to actually ask about why we're open access, I'd be very happy to answer that question if someone has to have to raise it. But in certain areas, particularly journal publishing, open access is very much feared, actually, in the arts and humanities as being an attack upon our freedoms as scholars and writers. But I'll leave that unless somebody wants me to address that directly. Brett, you had a question.
Why open access? No. I'll use that as a follow-up question. But the first question I have is a computer techie question, so I suppose you can field it too, Gabriel. Are you making the GIS information publicly available too?
So are you making the what information?
The geographical information system data that is...
Yes. Okay. Is the answer, yes. The National Grid reference numbers that we give for each location have been provided to us by the archaeologists, by particularly Julian Bowser of Museum of London Archaeology. And yes, you can have those. There isn't a GIS system underneath this. Our map is essentially, it's either Google Maps or OpenStreetMap, I forget which. But yes, all the data is available for download from the website. That's what I meant by the free and open sense. We created these things, and we think that we were paid to do them by the citizens of this country, and therefore we're not asserting any ownership of those things. Anything you don't see that you want, it's because we forgot to make it available, and if you ask, we'll make it available. But our attempt has been to give everything away. And yes, you did ask why open access, and it's just that we are public servants. The long-standing tradition of public servants retaining ownership or claiming ownership of the things they make really isn't sustainable. It's not just. People have paid for this work, and now here they can have it. Marion.
Picking that one up, Gabriel, and applauding it, unsurprisingly. Could I ask, encourage, whatever, that the website put in as many links as possible to, for example, Grace's Henslow papers, or, though I know this is Shakespeare and the London Theatre, records of early English drama, would, I'm pretty confident, welcome a link. And this seems to be very much in the spirit of what you're talking about and utterly appropriate.
The reason there isn't a page that says, and here are lots of other projects you might be interested in, is we had a conversation about how people find stuff. And there's no one place to go for Shakespeare. Nobody can be the Shakespeare portal. Arden tried to be the Shakespeare portal 14 years ago. Others may try in the next couple of years to be the... but our sense was people find stuff using Google search or Bing, whatever search they use. And that you're right, actually, there is a case for saying there's other projects. But we wouldn't expect... But we're not a portal. We're not the way that people get to all knowledge about this period. We think search is the way that they get that knowledge. Any more questions from the floor about the project? Yes, there's one.
I'm just a woman in the street. Oh,
do please take the... Could you take the microphone, just we are recording.
I see. Okay. Thanks. I didn't know why, because I could speak loudly. But I'm just somebody who came because I'm interested in Shakespeare, I'm interested in theatre. But why this particular project? Whose baby was it?
Whose baby was it?
For whom was it intended? And why necessarily the theatres? I mean, how did you get to this idea? That's what I wanted to know, basically.
Well,
who thought it out? And why?
I impregnated myself.
Oh, I see.
Perhaps you weren't here earlier when I...
No.
No, you weren't, right. I spoke about how... I didn't say very much, but back in November 2008, I went to a lecture given by Andrew Gurr here. Professor Andrew Gurr at the beginning of a three-day conference. It's called Inside Outside, I think, about inside theatre. He just might have known that. various things he said in that introductory lecture lit me up. Imaginatively, to think. I was teaching Shakespeare at the Open University at the time. I had been for years. I've done a book about Shakespeare on film, which I'm doing a second edition of at the moment. And I'm interested in both theatres and also Shakespeare on film and any other plays on film. So it came from that, really. Originally, I talked to Andy that I think that day, and. You said, how can I help? Which is a great invitation, I thought. And you've been helping ever since. And I thought an exhibition would crack it. But eventually it moved on in all sorts of different ways. One key moment came when I was still at the Open University at the time. I'm not there anymore. I think the research officer in the arts faculty where I worked, one day Milton Keynes, overheard me. I was overheard by someone talking to him, and he said, have you thought about location-aware software? And I said, what's that? And so I suppose the app came from that eventually, that we've now produced. You know, the idea that you could be on the street, say a visitor from anywhere other than London, or visiting London from elsewhere in the country, and you could, if you've got a smartphone, load it with the app. You could be taken on the street to these places. And now with the map available also from the smartphone, you can learn more about these theatres. So it was a personal kind of inspiration initially. And then I thought, well, this could be a goer, you know. And it went, and it's here.
Did you have a particular audience in mind? I mean, did you do it for, say, teachers?
Well,
was it intended, or anybody?
The general
really?
Public, the general interested public, you know, as we say. Therefore, it's a knowledge transfer project. It's called officially AHRC Speak. So it's transferred to you today via the VNA, and more generally using their. Using their audiences, as it were, of this theatre. It's the home of the history of theatre, meant to be in Britain, because of the gallery and the department. So it seemed an obvious place to come to do a partnership that would get the information out that's currently in more specialised forms, books, articles and so forth, to a general audience.
Can I add to
Thank
that?
You very much. Certainly Morris. Very interesting. Yeah.
One of the things that was really driving us was the feeling that the time has probably now come. A lot of stuff has been discovered in the last years, not just the Rose in 89 and then the Globe in 89, but the theatre and the curtain, the remains have been found. And in a way, that's inevitably absolutely minimal compared with, say, what there is in Spain. I mean, I went 20 years ago now, I went to a tiny place, well, a small town, called Alcalá de Henares, about 30 miles from Madrid, which had a complete theatre that was actually, it had actually started out as an open courtyard with a house around it and a shop at the front in the main square of the town. And in 1602, it was converted into the town's theatre. And it's still there. I mean, when I first went to it, they were ripping off the wallpaper and finding earlier and earlier and earlier stuff, wallpaper, plaster, etc., right back to 1602. It was all found and all there. Absolute marvelous record of what in the 17th century Spain had in the way of civic theatres. And there are two theatres in Spain, complete, that have been rebuilt on in various ways, but nonetheless are still there. We have nothing like that. We've got Hampton Court with the odd royal performance. We've got Middle Temple Hall for the one performance of Twelfth Night we know about, and one or two others. But very little of the actual professional theatres. And it was such a massive and massively popular activity. I mean, the commercial side was relatively late in latching on to the success of theatre in London through that time. And indeed, theatre throughout the country. It was travelling. The companies in London always took their summer holidays by travelling around the country. That was one of the many things that made it a vast, popular, and massively well-recorded, relatively speaking, given the number of plays that got into print, a very well-recorded thing. So it's, in a way, it's the biggest thing that happened around us. And Shakespeare is only one representative of all that activity. So it seemed to us that it was very well worth documenting the stuff with the latest technology so that we could, A, help people who are interested in seeing what might be found to tour around and find it. Hence the map and hence the app and all of that.
Thank you very much. Must go to Spain again.
Thanks. I think I'd like to draw proceedings to a close. I'd like to say that if you, as you exit through this door over here, you'll find copies of our guide are on sale at a very low price for you. If you have a badge, please come this way for our reception. But would you please thank our speakers?
On behalf of the museum, I'd also like to thank Gabriel for organising it all and being some fantastic hosts.
Thank
It's actually a fantastic day outside, so it's a perfect time, if you're walking out of the museum, to take your mat and go out and start walking. I just wanted to end on a strange thought, which might appeal for those of you who like 3D crossword puzzles, that the assumption, I think, this afternoon has been that nothing survives of any of these theatres above ground. But it's always been an interesting thought that when the theatre was demolished in 1599, get my facts right here, and the major timbers carted across the river eventually to build the first Globe Theatre, that I've always wondered what happened to all the bits that were left behind, because in fact there was a court case, I think, about all the damage that was done. And the following year, in 1600, a very large house, the Paul Pinder's house, was under construction about 600 metres south of that site. And I've always wondered if Sir Paul Pinder, being a shrewd businessman, had a look at the site of the theatre and thought, oh, there's a load of old second-hand wood there left over from the theatre. I wonder if I could reuse that in my huge new house. And for those of you that know the V&A well, if you wander down to the Medieval and Renaissance galleries, the front of Sir Paul Pinder's house, which amazingly survived in Bishopsgate Street, till 1878, I think, when it came to the V&A, is up on the wall. And I've always looked up at it and wondered if some of those timbers are actually surviving parts of the theatre. There are also engravings of the inside of the house, which no longer survives. So for those of you who don't want to get your hands dirty digging in the ground, you might like to have a look at that. And I've always thought it would be well worth... there was some dendrochronology done on it, seeing if actually the timbers date from a few years before the theatre was constructed. So maybe one day we'll find that we've had a little bit of the theatre on the wall of the V&A for 150 years. Anyway, with that thought, I hope you enjoy the rest of your time here. And as I said, it's a beautifully sunny afternoon for getting out and walking down to Shoreditch. Thanks very much. Bye.